Hello and good morning. This is 42 Minutes from thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting authors, thinkers, and philosophers of our day. Today is January 8th, 2013, and this is episode 66. I am Douglas Bowles, and today we're going to converse about the importance of a healthy ego. But first, as a sync aside, did you know it's David Bowie's birthday today, Doug? He announced the release of his 66th album this morning. So 66 is in the air. Hello, I'm Will Morgan, and welcome. Today on 42 Minutes, we will be speaking to Dr. Gibbs Williams, author, psychoanalyst, and host of GibbsOnline.com. We spoke to Dr. Williams last October about his thoughts on synchronicity as formulated in his book, Demystifying Meaningful Coincidences, which you can find in our archives on thesyncbook.com. And hit the radio tab and go to 42 minutes. We'd like to further that conversation this morning by exploring his mental health program, Attitude Shifting, which he developed with his brother. Good morning, Dr. Williams. How are you?
Good morning. Good, great.
You know, this book reads less as a book and more as a seminar. Is that a correct analysis?
Well, it's basically a resource manual.
There's plenty of exercises. There's plenty of reviews. I found that useful in bringing certain notes repeatedly up. Helped me really grasp some of the things that you were trying to teach us here. For example, with the internal and external.
I think it might be useful if I give you the origin of how this came about, because it really gets to the essence of what we're about. May I?
Oh, yes, please.
I'm 4.5 years older than my brother. Until our mother died, when I was 15 and he was 11, we got along famously. After that, a mother-in-law came into the house, and I think she really split us up. And we became very estranged for decades. We would call each other on our birthdays, so we talked twice a year, but that was about it. I called him about 3 years ago on his birthday, said, "How are you, Herbie?" And he paused and was obviously not in good shape. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, 3 weeks ago, I had a quadruple bypass. And I said, "Gee, that's terrible." I said, "Look, you know what I do for a living. If you ever want to talk, give me a call. We'll talk." Figuring he'll never call me. He's a hard-nosed realist, an insurance salesman, and the idea of psychodynamics and counseling and all that for a guy who's very stiff upper lippy would be impossible. Nevertheless, he called me the next day and indicated that in the Chicago winter weather, he was feeling symptoms of his heart attack problem and was very nervous, however, felt somewhat better by the fact that he'd gotten a clean bill of health the day before. So I said to him, "Look, panic attacks are often confused with having heart attacks, and if you want to, let me do my crisis intervention thing. Let's just talk about your feelings. See what happens." So we talked for about an hour. He called me back the next day. He said it was the best conversation he's ever had in his lifetime. And out of that came an idea that we both came up with simultaneously, which was to make a resource manual for potential first responders helping anybody who seemed to require aid in dealing with frustration, stress, anxiety, and depression, mainly without the use of drugs. So for 3 years, we collaborated almost daily on coming out with this e-manual. And it was obviously a benefit to both of us, where we were able to reconcile. And I figure if he could help me with my highfalutin words, and I could help him try to understand the concepts that there really is an inner reality, and it would be very good to try to understand the logic. And we really, truly, we were really helpful to each other, and I feel terrific. So if we two can get together after 40 years, this has to have some beneficial power for other people like us.
Well, I think that's what I was describing as far as the setup goes. I mean, there are some highfalutin words in here, but it's very layman. It's set out very easy to understand, and like I said, it goes back and it covers some ground again, so you can keep up. But I can't help but notice the relationship between this and your other work as far as synchronicity, because we're still we're dealing with meaning here. Would you agree with that?
Well, this is interesting. I was thinking about it last night. Relative to my particular theory of synchronicity, my research, 50-year research, the conditions for major synchronicities happen in a climate of people feeling desperately stuck, where they have a seemingly unresolved major problem in which they feel extremely pessimistic about ever getting a resolution. And the two attitudes to the problem are either a passive attitude where they sort of give up and, I don't know, turn to drink or chaos or whatever. The other attitude is that even in the face of pessimism about finding an adequate solution, they dedicate themselves to struggling with struggle, which I think turns on the creative process. And that creative process eventually leads to finding what I call clues in a psychological scavenger hunt. And when enough clues are found, they form a pattern where that pattern, when recognizable, has to be interpreted. But the important thing is, takes the form of a synchronicity, which is an indicator that an effective solution has been found. What we're doing in this manual is getting to that pre-part where people are stuck and trying to convert a passive attitude to feeling overwhelmed or being stuck into an active attitude shift where they are prepared to struggle with struggle, which, as I say, I think turns on the creative process. So the two really dovetail very neatly.
Okay, so then it would be helpful for our guests, perhaps, for you to explain the reality principle.
The reality principle, there are two principles relative to people being alive. The first principle is the pleasure principle, which tends to dominate childhood, in which it's very simple. It's, I want what I want when I want it. I want no interference. It should be a perfect, easy world, and don't say no to me. That's the pleasure principle. The reality principle happens roughly around 10, 11, 12 years old, where adults, it should be the adult principle, where it's in basic agreement with the pleasure principle. Everybody wants what they want when they want it, with no limitations. But adults, if they have lived long enough, at least a few that I know, indicate, well, everybody wants what they want when they want it, and there are inevitable differences, as like the Congress of the United States, where everybody is convinced they know the truth and everybody else is wrong. Obviously, it calls for some kind of, in this clash of opposites, it calls for some way to reconcile or to compromise, and the reality principle essentially is based upon the idea, perhaps you've heard it, id, ego, superego. The formula is where id, which is basic instincts, and superego, which is the internalized law, are, ego, which is the voice of reason, shall be. So in effect, it's being able to incorporate the ego, the voice of reason, as your guiding principle.
And the conflict between these, the pleasure principle and the reality principle, is what creates anxiety and stress and so
forth.
Yes,
precisely. That's exactly right.
And that was something interesting.
This is essentially, this is Freud's great contribution, in which he, which I am a total believer in. I know he's an outmoded old European and to be forgotten, which is, of course, absolutely an injustice and not true. There is an id, there is an ego, there is a superego, there is a self, there is a clash, and you're perfectly right that these so-called negative affects like depression and stress and so forth come out of the clash between these opposing positions.
One of the things that I wasn't familiar with that I liked is how you explained the nature of the difference. Depression is actually dealing with the past, anxieties, frustration of the future, and so this gap between the pleasure principle and the reality principle produces the stressors that put people into that sense of stuckness.
Yeah, and that's an important point, which I think really has to be emphasized, is that contrary to the drug companies, who would like you to believe that depression, anxiety, stress, and all that are really pathological symptoms, which you shouldn't have to endure, so pop the next pill or combination of pills and get rid of all this nonsense. When the truth of it is, it's a great lie and they know it. The truth of the matter is that depression, anxiety, stress, and frustration are all natural reactions to normal limitations, and the truth is to have a strong identity, and I guess to be what we would call mentally healthy, you have to learn how to effectively cope with each of these things.
Right, and so that was what was fascinating about the program is it puts the onus on the individual to just, it's the serenity prayer, to accept, instead of responding to the negative things in one's life with negative, you just have to positively accept the burdens of life.
If you could take the serenity prayer and operationalize it, in other words, take each one of those three principles and apply it to your own direct experience, you would come out a mentally healthy person. That's exactly what we're aiming at.
Which is fascinating to me because of how successful Alcoholics Anonymous is as a program. So it does have a mystical component, but at the other hand, it really does force the individuals involved to become have a healthy ego and identity.
Well, I nice try. if you don't mind.
Yes.
Up to a point. To me, it's a bit too doctrinaire and unintegrated. Too steppy. I appreciate the steps. I think the first one is great. However, I think that there is too little emphasis on struggling with struggle from a holistic point of view. And I may be quibbling, and I'm not being fair. And, of course, it does obviously work for many people. However, once again, I think it has to do with a particular kind of attitude. I like the idea of struggling with struggle. It's got less to do with willpower. And for me, this idea of surrendering to a higher power is a little bit too passive from my point of view. You're surrendering to your own experience.
Well, so that was the thing that was – so I really appreciated the self-empowerment of the attitude-shifting program, but then the thought I was having was when someone's bathed in an anxiety attack where they're having what is an irrational fear of something that is mostly in their head, you know, and maybe you should explain anxiety a little bit, but – you know, how do you choose when you can't, your brain is behaving irrationally, how do you choose to be positive in that moment when, you know, your whole body is shutting down, you're trying to cower in fear, and what you want is...
It's a very good question. You know, I think the idea that that anxiety is irrational is not in accord with my experience, either with myself or patients. The origin of anxiety is essentially a message from the forebrain, the earliest brain of mammals, of which human beings are a mammal. So we're animals. Anxiety is essentially the reaction to the perception of a real or imagined danger. It could be rational or irrational. But there has to be a perception that something outside one or inside one is possibly going to attack you. You attack yourself or you'll be attacked by some external enemy force or what have you. And it prepares, it shoots adrenaline into the system automatically from the forebrain, which alerts the system, which energizes the system for fight or flight. And it's really absolutely necessary. If we didn't have it, you'd be walking around, let's say, New York City, 3 o'clock in the morning. If your head isn't turned, you know, often to find out who's possibly in the shadows, you can get mugged and killed in 5 minutes. So it's really, it's a necessary defense. It's an early warning system which prepares the person with adequate protection from real or imagined enemies. Now, what's important is that adrenaline can either be experienced as fear, which is not an irrational experience. If there's a mugger that's coming after you, you should be scared out of your mind and either, you know, duck or run like hell. So that's fear. But if there is no mugger, but you feel like you're going to be attacked, then the source of the fear reaction usually is the re-experiencing of some trauma from the past, which might have involved a mugging or being attacked or bullied in the schoolyard, in which somehow or other something in the present has triggered off the memory of this forgotten or repressed trauma from the past, so that what's experienced is not so much fear as it is anxiety. And the third possibility is that it's excitement. So if you go on rides in the carnival and you get shaken up for 3 minutes, you are probably going to experience all three. There's a fear of falling out of the thing and dying. There may be an anxiety about being twirled over your head, over your father's head, and fear you're going to be dropped. And it's exciting. So all three of those, there is the meaning attached to the context, is what gives the experience its name.
This reminds me of when I was younger, I had the experience of drinking too much and getting caught driving, and they made me take an alcohol mm-hmm. class, excuse me, where they introduce you and tell you what alcohol does to your body, and it educates you. All of a sudden I was like, oh, this is what beer is doing to me. This is, you know, I can take a beer. It takes an hour for it to get out of my system, so forth and so forth. This feels a lot like that, because it's like, okay, these are the experiences you're going to have as a human being, but this is how you recognize them, this is how you deal with them, and this is how you navigate through them.
Correct.
Because I've kind of fooled with a little bit of this on my own, and this just gave me some few exercises, but I noticed that, like, say when you wake up in the morning and you stump your toe and you're like, dag nabbit, but that it, like a synchronicity, all of a sudden the whole day will be tainted with frustration, or, you know, you get in the car and somebody's in front of you, you're late for work, you forget to do this at work.
Reality can be determined by that stubbing your toe and the pain, the feeling of vulnerability and so forth through the prism of that one experience. It's true. We do that all the time.
Yes, yes. And so this is kind of like giving you a couple of exercises to pivot or shift the attitude when that initial, that toe stumping happens. You sit back and you recognize the frustration and you work it out before the rest of your day even begins.
Let me backtrack a little bit and see if this is helpful. As a psychoanalyst, I see new patients come in, and they typically, anybody who comes in, usually is in a state of crisis. What's crisis? Essentially, crisis is when somebody wants to be able to do something and they can't, or they want to stop something and they can't. And the bottom line of crisis is that people feel overwhelmed either by too much activity or too little activity, that in effect, if you look at the self as an engine, they're coming in with an inefficient engine. Parts are missing, or they're spilling all over the place, or it doesn't go on, or they're imbalanced. And the way that the imbalance is experienced is usually through one or more of these basic feelings of anxiety, depression, stress, and frustration, or often a mixture of them. And it's identifying these feelings. And then the next step, which is, I think, our contribution to dealing with this stuff more effectively, is not only identifying you are now experiencing anxiety attack, or you're very depressed, or you're frustrated, or what have you, which is useful, but inquiring as to the attitude that each person has about these four feelings. And what I have found is that, and generally it's not practiced, it's not in the literature, or if it is, I'm not privy to it, in which people, if you ask a person, what's your experience of anxiety? often they will tell you, I get anxious when I'm anxious. I get depressed when I'm depressed. I get frustrated when I'm frustrated. And I get stressed out when I'm stressed out. Now, that becomes exceedingly important because instead of just simply trying to cope with those feelings, our contribution is that you're trying to shift the attitude from one of being attacked and you feel helpless and hopeless to learning to struggle with the particular feeling. And the way it's done is to learn how to tolerate, not like, but put up with, increasing dosages of whatever the negative feeling is. And it's got enormous side benefits because it leads to empowerment. It leads to a feeling of hopefulness. It leads to a feeling of, I can do something to change my feelings. And in doing that, it's extremely empowering.
And this is what I appreciated most, I think, about the program. The idea that you, when you find that dark spot, you don't run from it, but you go into it. It's like room 237 in The Shining.
May I quote you?
Sure.
I'll tell you why this is so important. Take PTSD, soldiers returning from the war, or take college kids, sophomores, usually, who wake up with panic attacks and so forth, go to mental health clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows. It's common knowledge. Take the soldiers coming from battle. They're a mess. All right, they go to the VA. The VA is reasonably good in hooking somebody up for the first interview. They're reasonably bad when they tell them that the first counseling session is going to be about 4 months, if they're lucky. Maybe 2 months. Maybe a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, these guys are going out of their minds.
Right.
And, you know, every day in the paper, you know, people, you know, they get smashed, they go crazy, they shoot up things. They need effective intervention immediately, and intervention that lasts, that isn't short range. Our program or the way we intervene provides the speed and the efficiency in dealing with these overwhelming feelings that also last a long time, is cost effective, often without the use of medication.
What do you make of the mental health of the nation? And
terrible. It's disgusting. With all that we know and all the resources, hey, you want to say, I wish I could promote this thing. I'm 75 years old, maybe 76 next month. You want to save money for mental health? Take our program. Put it in the schools. Put it in the Army. Teach kids how to do this. I believe, seriously, I know this is going to sound really grandiose, but from my personal experience, knowing that stress and anxiety are often behind every single ailment, there's a psychological component, that they could save billions of dollars on individuals like you and me learning how to effectively deal with people who need help in dealing with this stuff. This stuff is powerful.
That's the same thing that I thought about the whole drinking and driving class. It's like, you guys should have taught me this a long time ago, and I would have never. It's what you mentioned in the book. It's fighting the. It's waiting till the symptoms happen, and then they try to fix the symptoms instead of cutting it off the source itself.
Look, go back to medication. You know what happens? There are a million ads on TV which indicate, call your doctor with the next symptom of anxiety, frustration, what have you. And we got purple pills and yellow pills and combinations, and pop a pill, wake them up in the morning, and get the most current pill. Well, isn't that lovely? Now, if you will listen carefully to each ad, you will hear a string of about 50 side effects, and you begin to wonder, if you're a halfway reasonable person, is the cure worse than the disease? And often it is. It's terrible. In addition to which, listen to this little fact. About 65 to 75% of the value in reducing anxiety and depression due to medication is due to a placebo effect, meaning the role that the mental part of oneself, the psychological part, the attitude that one has towards one's symptoms is crucial. And they will tell you this, that's the last thing in the world they're going to broadcast, In addition to which, we have this fantasy that only official healthcare providers can do good intervention work. It has been demonstrated, it's really very interesting, the sociological research, that in Africa, for example, until fairly recently, even though they have terrible conditions, which we all know about, the general level of stress and anxiety was relatively low, but it's gotten out of proportion, and they're as bad as everybody else now. Well, what happened? Well, with migrations, the social system, the social network has been pulled apart, and what used to be left up to folks dealing with, you know, intervening and providing good care, if effective bedside manner, which goes a long way to doing this and applying common sense, is no longer acceptable. And so you have a health care provider problem. But the truth of it is, with anybody who is a relatively caring person, who's empathic, who can learn how to intervene in these specific ways where they're not pushing somebody, they're enlisting, they're working together, creating an alliance, and providing these principles can really affect enormous changes if you get the person to be able to shift their attitude from "I'm falling apart and crazy" to "I'm relatively empowered and I got a sense of what to be able to do." Anybody can do this.
Okay, so the core of the attitude shifting program is moving the individual from passive stuckness to active momentum and addressing their holistic being instead of just the symptoms of depression and anxiety.
Correct. So there's a five-step discovery program. Step 3A is being able to recognize that there's a person or persons out there that need to be or would like to be helped in effectively coping with these things. So you engage the patient or the person.
So then my devil's advocate thought is the other side of the coin. So this is someone who's motivated to make their life better. They're going to make their attitude shift. But what if it's not so much a choice of trying to be different, to change, you know, to change
right.
the present,
right.
but they don't have any choice where they're addicted to some debilitating thing where they want to change, or they have a sense that they need to change, but they can't change. With someone dealing with addiction to prescription drugs or debilitating behavior.
All right, let me translate. So you're saying somebody, an addict of whatever, comes in and says, "I'm hooked on drugs, alcohol, whatever the addiction is."
Right.
From my research in 40 years of this stuff on the front lines of addiction, the basic problem in all addiction, irrespective of the substance, sex, drugs, rock and roll, doesn't matter, is the ability to tolerate increasing dosages of frustration. Once again, if you experience frustration as overwhelming, then you can't change. If you undertake certain exercises, not too complex, and if you look at exercise one, which I may even go into, and do that 15 minutes a day for a week, most people will experience that they are able to go beyond not tolerating frustration to tolerating it maybe for the first time in their lives. And once they do that, they will get a sense of empowerment that they, by doing something, by struggling with struggle, will actively be able to change their addictive behavior. It almost feels miraculous. Hmm. But it's not. It's not nothing mystical. It has to do with applying scientific principles to the way we work internally.
It has the same effect, though, as a mystical experience.
That's true.
Okay.
Yes, it may indeed feel that way.
Okay, this is, quote, "There are essentially two psychological theories which attempt to explain how we humans order our perceptions. These two theories are, number one, stimulus response, or SR behavioral conditioning, and two, stimulus organism response, SOR,
Correct.
Depth psychology. Which
Right.
one do you subscribe to?"
Both. In terms of being pragmatic about what ails patients, it to some extent, it's different strokes for different folks. The more comprehensive is the SOR, which has the assumption that there's a basic inner reality and that behavior is more than simply conditioned responses.
The thing that I'd like to come back to, the interesting little thing, was that oftentimes, or you mentioned that a synchronicity is oftentimes a key into that person's passive stuckness, that's the thing that'll reach them, the synchronicity. And so how do you...
No. The synchronicity begins in an arena of stuckness,
yeah.
And then one's attitude to the stuckness, I think, initiates one's own creative process, where you are in effect, you're in effect creating your own solution. It feels almost like it's something out of nothing.
And does that demystify the synchronicity because it's actually the architecture of the individual trying to solve their problem? That's they create the synchronicity they need.
Jung, who's the foremost, acknowledged master of synchronicities, and here's where he and I differ, essentially believes that in addition to one's own creative self, that in a synchronicity, you're literally making a connection with the so-called collective unconscious, and I think this is accurate, that the collective unconscious is a repository of basic capital T truths, and you're literally making a connection with divine wisdom or what have you, and that's the mystical component in his idea of synchronicity formation. I think that's a really charming idea, but from my vantage point, totally deluded, that it has to do with, I don't believe in that stuff. I believe that one is their own final authority. I believe that there's nothing outside of one, or there may be whatever there is outside of one. But you have to lend your own final authority to whatever that stuff is. In other words, a given synchronicity to one person is probably going to have an entirely different interpretation than to another. It could be the same synchronicity.
Your exercise on distinguishing between internal space and external space,
right.
I thought that was useful in trying to understand what you because you're saying that the synchronicity is an internal process that one projects.
Both Jung and I would say there's two processes going on. There's whatever you, it's essentially making meaning. Whenever you make meaning, you're obviously calling upon some kind of internal process, whether you're aware of it or not, and then you're joining up whatever it is that you're discovering with whatever meaning you produce internally, is connecting with some parallel meaning from the outside. What becomes interesting in terms of understanding synchronicities is how do those two things that seem parallel get together? And then you either have a sort of mystical bent that it's you're led by divine intervention to the right place, the right person at the right time, or that, as I believe, once you have understood what meanings you are giving to external experience, there's some pattern, there's some external experience which is going to parallel your internal self.
Yeah.
This has a lot to do with time, like you said, the right place at the right time. I mean, could you speak a little bit on our confusion as far as linear time and durational time is concerned?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most fascinating things I've seen. I had an analyst who, I had a preoccupation with time. I hated linear time. I hated a watch. However, he said early on, that confused me for years until I began to get the point. He said there is no time. Time is a convenient construction that human beings have made in order to have an essential agreement that you guys are going to call me at 11:15 today, and I'm going to be here waiting for your call. So we have an agreement in terms of clock time. That's linear time. Linear time is the feeling that in as we are right now, that to the left of us is the past, to the right of us is the future, and in the middle is current time or now. The reality is that past, present, future is just convenient constructions. It's all an eternal presence. All right, now what does this really mean? How does this translate? From the vantage point of the developing child, durational time is essentially equivalent to playtime or childhood consciousness. Children up until about 2, 3, 4 years old even have no sense of time. It's just timeless. It's just event after event after event. Then you plug in linear time or cause and effect time. Now, in synchronicities, the thing that I found is most important is that there is an overlapping of durational time and linear time. And that's what makes for the uncanny feeling of meaningful connections, both internally and externally. I don't think I gave a very good explanation, but the exploration of time is really extremely important.
As far as frustration and synchronicity goes, it seems.
That's an interesting point of view. When people come in crisis, they're feeling torn apart. They're feeling unbalanced. They're feeling their lives are on the line. And what they're saying to any helper, whether overtly or covertly, is, I am drowning. I am in a pond, and I'm going under for the third time. Would you please rescue me? And then in crisis intervention, it's relatively easy to know what to do, because if the patient needs to be rescued, then you throw in the equivalent of a long stick, and you tell the patient or the person in need of help, hold on, I'll pull you out. So that time is immediate. It's current. There is no time. There's no past time. There's no future time. It's right now. I'm drowning. Do something. That's why actively acting and providing something to hold on to immediately is extremely important for effective crisis intervention. That's why the PTSD, it is cruel and inhuman punishment for these guys to have to wait 6 weeks to get their first counseling appointment.
And so if we think of the ego like a good spacesuit that's keeping you safe from the harshness of space, what are your thoughts on this new age notion of ego death and the midlife crisis and, you know, that kind of whole mystical?
I don't know enough about, I think what you're talking about is this diffusion of Buddhism into psychoanalytic thinking, and it's a tempting way to go. It's seductive and so forth. But if ego means to empty oneself and just take everything in and merge with this kind of wholeness and all that, to me, the issue is not so much wholeness, it's making separations and distinctions. I think it's a romantic fantasy. It doesn't hold from my experience.
And so then what do you do with someone who's come to you in their midlife? They have everything. They have a good job, a good career, a family, and they feel there's an emptiness. They've got a void that they're trying to fill, and they go through various, you know, this is the Ferrari and the
blonde. It's really the problem of our day. It's a search for meaningful connections. And either following this manual and or my theory of synchronicities will inevitably lead to an in-depth investigation of the nature of meaning-making. And just very briefly, I like the distinction between being and doing. And I think what we're discovering in our lives is that there's an overemphasis of doing. The job is most important. How much money you've acquired, you know, what kind of wealth factor do you have, what kind of positioning is much too overvalued. And the crisis, midlife often crisis, is I have all this stuff, but I'm unhappy because there's not enough emphasis on being and value and what's really important and answering the central questions in one's life, which is what's really important and how do I know it?
Okay, a lot to process.
We're at about 40 minutes. We've been speaking with Dr. Gibbs Williams about his program, Attitude Shifting, which you can purchase at his website, attitudeshifting.com, I think. or on...
By the way, if there's a Kindle, if you have Kindles, you can download this thing for $3. If not, I think the cost is something like $9 or something like that. And I'll make a deal. If anybody buys these things, they don't like it, write to me. I'll pay. I'll give you back your money. Oh, in addition to which, on the website, attitudeshifting.com, my brother just made a, what are those things you use on the iPhone? An app.
Oh, yes.
That has all this information on it. It's really good.
An attitude shifting app available
on
the website.
Attitudeshifting.com.
Yeah, I noticed that the first part of the book is very heavy in information and sort of prompting people, but the real meat of it is the exercises at the end, the interactive.
Well, you know, there are two kinds of people. You know, people like the nerds of the world enjoy the theory and where all this comes from. The meat and potato guys say, look, just tell me what to do. We have both, and you use the manual in whatever way it fits you.
The nerds of the world, I think. That might be
which I am.
Might be us in 42 minutes.
Yeah.
Nerds of the world, you know. By the way, I have a third thing, if I might.
Please,
I worked at a place called Odyssey House, which was a heroin addiction therapeutic community in 1966. I kept an ongoing journal for the first 17 months I worked there. For the first 5 months, I thought it was an ideal place. The next part was the bowels of hell. I have this journal that I'm publishing, and I think it's going to be called something like Good and Evil in a Therapeutic. And my Odyssey House was a nightmare. Early intervention. What was it? I don't know the second part. It's also part of this whole search for meaning and what's of value and what's good and what's evil. So if I can induce you guys to let me send this to you, see what you think, and I'd love to be on again.
Oh, I would enjoy the hell out of that. So.
Yeah. Well, that's 42
it's,
minutes
it's today. It's immodestly the best book ever written on addiction.
Maybe that's the next facet to this conversation. But thank you so much, Dr. Williams, for coming on again. It was.
Oh, this is a pleasure. This is very I really appreciate this. It's very nice.
And next week, I think we're back to Sync Book 2 talking with one of the members of Riot Fish. Until then, thank you so much and have a great week.
Dr. Williams.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.